Soviet Premier Bulganin and Red China's Premier Zhou Enlai have issued a 2,000-word communique from Moscow resolutely condemning the Eisenhower Doctrine for the Middle East. They pledge any necessary support to prevent either armed aggression or interference in the internal affairs of the countries of that region. Soviet Russia and Red China would not wait for the United States to strike. They would move first without invitation and without reference to any military moves the United States might make. The moment they decide we have intervened in the internal affairs of any Middle Eastern country, they would feel free to do as they please. The military provisions in the Eisenhower Doctrine, on the other hand, do not take effect until after the communists have committed an act of military aggression in the Middle East, and then only if the victim of that attack requests United States aid. Bulganin and Zhou Enlai do not propose countering the Eisenhower Doctrine in the Middle East. They propose anticipating it. And the whole purpose of the Eisenhower Doctrine is to prevent the communists from carrying out the threat that Bulganin and Zhou Enlai have now made. But the fact that Bulganin and Zhou Enlai have made that threat does not mean they plan to carry it out at an early date or any other time. Rather, the opposite. It's a propaganda countermove, and about the only thing that seems certain is that it will encourage the Congress to act sooner and more favorably on the Eisenhower Doctrine than it would have done if Bulganin and Zhou Enlai had kept their trap shut. Their Moscow communique also reaffirms the stand the Soviet government has already taken, calling upon Britain, France, and Israel to compensate Egypt for damage suffered during the recent fighting. Bulganin and Zhou Enlai likewise charge President Eisenhower with creating new tension in the Middle East, trying to enslave the peoples of the area, as the British and French did before him. The two communist leaders, on the other hand, announce support for the peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America in their fight against colonialism. They welcome the resumption of Soviet-Japanese relations and call for closer relations between Red China and Japan. More or less in passing, they kissed off the Hungarian rebellion with a sneer at imperialist intrigues against the socialist camp. As usual, the communists pursue the political offensive, where the trend of events flows in their direction. And the news from Cairo does justify rejoicing in Moscow and Peking. Wilton Wynn of the Associated Press cables that NASA's latest nationalization, covering all foreign banks, insurance, and importing companies in Egypt, may prove a bigger revolution than the seizure of Suez or the overthrow of King Farouk. Osgood Carruthers wrote in exactly the same vein in this morning's New York Times. Foreign and Egyptian observers agree that Egypt's economic break with the West will accelerate that country's progress toward the communist bloc. Foreigners get what satisfaction they can by predicting that Egypt's middle classes are now doomed and that the whole Egyptian economy will eventually collapse because it cannot develop enough trade with the communist world to maintain living standards even at present meager levels. And Nasser and his circle get what satisfaction they can from their conviction that even if they ruin themselves and wreck their country, they'll ruin the foreigners and wreck Europe in the process. Winds from the Middle East have borne in this further straw of rumor from Cairo. President Nasser is said to be working overtime to commit King Saud of Saudi Arabia to sign on the dotted line, along with King Hussein of Jordan, Premier Asali of Syria, and Abdel Gamar himself, Nasser. All would agree that Jordan should receive from Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Egypt a yearly subsidy of $36 million to replace the subsidy Jordan used to get from Britain. And President Nasser won't be happy unless he can get King Saud's signature on this agreement before King Saud takes off for his visit to President Eisenhower on January 30th. The one ray of hope for the Middle East still comes from the United Nations. There, Britain's Minister of State, Alan Noble, has joined United States Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. in urging international control for the Gaza Strip and free navigation in the Gulf of Aqaba. Noble also joined Lodge in urging the Israelis to get their troops out of those two regions at once. Canada's Lester Pearson has suggested that United Nations forces move in, but India's V.K. Krishnamenon got back in his fellow traveling groove as he demanded that Israeli troops at once quit Egypt, but warned that Indian troops in the United Nations Emergency Force should not occupy what he called any controversial area. Well, if the United Nations or its emergency force is ever to accomplish anything, it is only by moving into controversial areas. But those are the areas from which Krishna Menon would hold aloof, unless, of course, the Soviet leaders favor moving in. What's really happening in Hungary seems just about as hard to understand as what's really happening in the Middle East. The four-man United Nations mission has just returned from its quiet, on-the-spot survey of Hungary's relief needs with a 23-page report to the General Assembly. Philippe Dessain, the Frenchman who heads the group, reports that direct distribution of bread, grain, and feed to consumers will be physically difficult or impossible, and free distribution in sizable quantities would be undesirable on general economic grounds. He therefore suggests selling supplies through normal economic channels. A United States spokesman pointed out that any plan to sell relief supplies on a commercial basis would have to get the approval of Congress. He also said distribution would have to be guaranteed on a non-political, impartial, fair basis, and that the United States does not want in any way to bolster up the regime against which the people of Hungary are protesting. The trouble here is that if the American people are not prepared to risk war to overthrow that regime, then they must deal with it or refrain from sending any kind of relief to the Hungarian people on any terms. The Red Cross has estimated that it will be able to distribute about $30 million worth of supplies to Hungary during the next 6 or 7 months. The communist countries say they have promised $80 million worth of immediate economic aid. And the Budapest Radio has announced the expulsion of Colonel James M. Cowley, the British Embassy's military attaché, who is charged with active and direct contacts with several leaders of the counter-revolution. This is the first foreigner to be expelled, foreign serviceman to be expelled from Budapest. Today, Soviet officials announced that on Wednesday they had summoned to Moscow Janos Kadar, the premier of their puppet government in Hungary, a man broken long since by physical and mental torture. Night before last in the Kremlin, Zhou Enlai received a personal briefing on Hungary from the shattered Kadar, and today Zhou Enlai arrived in Warsaw. He will spend the better part of a week touring Poland. Then he'll go to Budapest, see Kadar again, and return to Moscow. Well, Poland's Premier Cyrankiewicz and party boss Gomułka, who have asked for American aid, stood grimly by while Zhou Enlai denounced the United States. And yet, Cyrankiewicz and Gomułka have plenty of opposition inside Poland from those who want more freedom from Moscow, better relations with the United States, wider democracy at home. So, to prove they remain devout communists, Cyrankiewicz and Gomułka praised Red China's efforts to preserve peace and expressed hope that communist Poland and Red China would be still more closely linked. Presumably, Kadar has by now returned to Hungary, where familiar scenes would have greeted him had he dared to go out and see in person what's going on. Soviet tanks have returned to the streets of Budapest. Communist Hungarian militiamen have opened fire on workers who've lost their jobs. There was a mass anti-communist demonstration at a big railway yard near the city. 5,000 of the 38,000 workers in the great industrial complex at Chapel Island gathered around the plant's main entrance at 9 this morning. Militiamen opened fire, angry workers threw bricks at them. The demonstrators demanded the ousting of Kadar, and they're protesting the reappointment of a hated plant supervisor. 50 high school students have burned Russian language textbooks outside their school building. That's going to be an instructive visit Zhou Enlai will pay to Budapest, but how much will he be willing and able to learn? Zhou Enlai is a whole generation closer to a real revolution than are his Russian hosts. Whether that will make him tougher or more teachable, only the future can tell. Delegates from the United States and Egypt have again locked arms at United Nations headquarters against Israel. For the third successive day, a United States spokesman has urged the Israelis to pull back their troops behind the 1949 armistice lines. The Israelis still hold 40% of the Sinai Desert, and they have said they will not return the Gaza Strip back to Egypt. The United States spokesman warned that as long as Israel does not fully comply with United Nations resolutions calling for complete withdrawal, such refusal is not a trump card, but the reverse. And Egypt's Foreign Minister Fawzi has written Dag Hammarskjöld, Secretary General of the United Nations, threatening in his government's name extremely serious consequences unless compliance with the assembly resolutions be secured without any delay. Apparently, Fauzi is not threatening new military action against Israel. That would be suicide for Egypt in view of the beating the Egyptians took at Israeli hands in the Sinai Desert. Rather, does Fauzi want to have the United Nations condemn Israel for stalling? Indeed, the Afro-Asian bloc is now working on the text of a resolution along those lines. Hammarskjöld expects Israel to make a progress report on Monday concerning further troop withdrawals from the Sinai Desert. The work of clearing the Suez Canal goes forward, and Hammarskjöld is still trying to devise some kind of formula that will bring the Egyptians into negotiations with the British and French. I'll be back with you in 30 seconds after a brief message from our announcer.
In Austria, more than 100,000 Hungarian refugees lack even the bare necessities of life. They fought for freedom. They need and deserve our help. Send your contribution to your local Red Cross chapter, to the nearest care office, or contribute through your own church or synagogue. If you wish, you can send your contribution directly to the American Red Cross, Washington, D.C., to CARE, New York City, or Church World Service, Catholic Relief Services, or the United Jewish Appeal. And now back to Quincy Howe.
Harold Macmillan, Britain's new prime minister, has received a good press so far. The conservative Daily Telegraph of London calls him the best available choice. The independent London Times wishes that the more progressive R.A. Butler had been given the job and warns Macmillan not to affiliate himself with the Tory diehards. The liberal Manchester Guardian and the conservative London Economist make the same point. The Liberal News Chronicle of London calls Macmillan's appointment a surprise and suggests the new prime minister may not be the reactionary that some of his enemies have called him. The Labourite Daily Herald minces no words. Mr. Macmillan is almost the worst prime minister possible at the present time. Yale Newman, London correspondent for the American Broadcasting Company, reports that the new British prime minister is ready to fly to lunch to Washington the moment he's invited to come. Mr. Macmillan is said to deplore the current anti-Americanism in Britain and regards it as a sign of British weakness and insecurity. Macmillan wants the country to get that poison out of its system just as fast as possible for its own good. And he's working on a new master plan to strengthen Anglo-American unity. Macmillan also hopes to strengthen British ties with the nations of Western Europe. And he hopes to build a solid West European bloc that will speak in a single voice at the United Nations, just as the Afro-Asian countries do. Macmillan, according to Yale Newman, may prove the biggest man Britain has produced since Churchill. Eden is now depicted as a very sick man, a man who will never regain his full strength and may not even recover from the illness that forced his resignation. Harold Macmillan's reactionary tendencies, by the way, against which all Labourites, most liberals, and many conservatives have issued warnings, may have a certain advantage, because it may well be that only such a man can lead a united conservative party and a united British people in an orderly retreat from the exposed positions that the Eden cabinet tried and failed to hold. Some Democrats on the House Foreign Affairs Committee want to revise President Eisenhower's resolution on the Middle East. They would merely reaffirm the United States policy of seeking to preserve peace through the United Nations. The Eisenhower resolution, which the Democratic chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee helped phrase, gives the president some authority to order United States troops into the Middle East. But there are so many strings attached that the president could do but little, and he could not do that little until after the accident in the Middle East had happened. The Democrats charge that the resolution on which their own leaders have collaborated is so cluttered up with phrases that nobody knows what it means. Republicans charge that the simpler Democratic substitute has just one merit. It clearly means nothing at all. Leonard Hall has turned in his resignation as chairman of the Republican National Committee, and President Eisenhower has accepted it with regret and praise. The first thing Mr. Hall will do is take a 6 weeks vacation in Florida. Then he'll decide whether to return to law practice at Oyster Bay, Long Island, or accept appointment to some federal post. Chances are he'll seek the Republican nomination for governor of New York in 1958 and try to unseat Governor Harriman. Or, as Mr. Hall prefers to put it, my service to my country and my party has not yet ended. Meanwhile, he needs to repair his personal fortunes. He has served without pay for the past 2 years and has worked with the Eisenhower administration for the past four. Leonard Wood Hall was born in 1900, the son of Theodore Roosevelt, coachman, and the namesake of General Leonard Wood, under whom T.R. served in the Spanish-American War. Mr. Hall began practicing law as a member of the New York Bar at the age of 21. He was a member of the New York State Assembly and served as a member of the House of Representatives for 14 years. He and Jim Folly learned their politics in the same school, Hall as a Republican, Folly as a Democrat, and they have much in common. Both are stout, genial, smart extroverts. As New Yorkers, they have the good sense to know that national politics begins somewhere beyond the Hudson River, but that many of the same principles that work in local New York State politics will work in national politics, too. Mr. Hall has had long experience in Washington. He stands in well with all factions of the Republican Party. If he could get himself elected governor of New York State, he would at once become a king maker. But he may be starting just a little too late in life to become himself a king. West Germany's Chancellor Adenauer has created what the British call a flap in the State Department. He held a news conference in his capital city of Bonn where he declared the thermonuclear weapons can no longer be considered as a means of waging war. Well, this is massive retaliation with a vengeance. Secretary Dulles has always assumed and frequently declared that our ability to deliver atomic and nuclear bombs on targets inside Russia has kept the peace thus far. And Sir Winston Churchill coined the phrase balance of terror to describe the uneasy truce that has prevailed since the Russians developed their nuclear bombs. And now comes the State Department's number one protege, Konrad Adenauer, calling for an international ban on testing and making H-bombs. Adenauer made no mention of the old-fashioned atomic bomb. What shocked State Department officials was that Dr. Adenauer, without advance warning or consultation, came out for what sounds like an echo of the Soviet proposals for nuclear disarmament. Here is Adenauer, like Bulgani, saying nothing about any system of international inspection or control. Worse yet, Dr. Adenauer took as his point of departure the 500-mile demilitarized zone that Bulgani has suggested between the Soviet Union and its Western neighbors, 500 miles on each side of the Iron Curtain. That proposal will not in and of itself keep the peace, said Adenauer, but it's a step in the right direction and can lead only to an improvement in the international situation. When word of the Adenauer news conference reached the State Department in Washington, press officer Lincoln White informed Washington newsmen that he had no comment for the simple but sufficient reason that he had no copy of the Adenauer text. Over last weekend, Soviet and East German officials issued a joint statement from Moscow endorsing the 500-mile demilitarized zone on both sides of the Iron Curtain and the open skies inspection plan that the Soviet leaders suggested over that zone. Adenauer faces a tough election campaign next fall, and his support of this Soviet proposal could mean that it's so popular in West Germany he doesn't dare oppose it. Adlai Stevenson did himself and his campaign little good when he called a few months ago for some of the same measures Chancellor Adenauer championed today. But West Germany is not the United States, and 1957 is not 1956.
Good evening, everyone. Are you shivering? Well, cheer up. Warmer weather on the way, but two-thirds of the country is shivering tonight. And watch out for that snow shoveling. 43 dead. Mostly heart. Late word on taxes, a new drive tonight, a drive to cut capital gains taxes by half and cut the waiting time to 3 months instead of six. Investors are hanging on to $200 billion worth of unrealized profits because of what they consider the high capital gains tax. Well, put these two together, they belong. When Prime Minister Harold Macmillan moved into 10 Downing Street, all he had to do was leave number 11 Downing Street and move into number 10, and he was home. But elsewhere in London, a woman driving her car ran out of gas and out of ration coupons at the same time, about a mile from her home. What did she do? She bought a bottle of whiskey, poured it into her gas tank, and with a bang like a bomb, she got home at $5 a mile. That bang is Macmillan's first big job, to get more gasoline before everybody runs out of whiskey. Well, Mr. Eaton's resignation seems to be permanent. He turns down an earldom, resigns his 30-year seat in the House of Parliament. But his resignation leaves a question. How can you tell when a man is a statesman? How can we tell which of our diplomats are statesmen? Yet they've got the world in their hands, haven't they? Anthony Eden was born into it, groomed for it, made a name in it. All around the world, people said, hurrah for the man who refuses to polish Hitler's scurvy boots. Here was a man trained under the number one statesman living, Churchill. And people wondered, how could he ever miss? Yet he goes out a broken, beaten man. If you asked him, he might say, I'm the same Anthony Eden they used to cheer. I refuse to let Hitler toss his weight around. Now I refuse to let Nasser and Khrushchev toss to their weight. But for one, I was a hero, and for the other, I'm forced to quit. Am I wrong? Or are the times wrong, or what? You'll have to find a wiser man than I am to answer his question. But Mr. Eaton did the whole world a favor when he resigned, because we've got to begin from the very beginning now with a new man. And you can't begin without a policy, and the one thing we never had for the Middle East was a policy. Oh, I mean an open, declared, agreed, understood policy. One we understood and our allies understood. At times you had the feeling some people had a Middle East policy in four words. Is Mr. Nasser happy? Well, you heard what I said about the weather. Please watch out. But here's some important news about a brand new way to relieve the pain of arthritis and rheumatism, and without pills, which might upset your stomach. You'll need one to figure this out. If Nasser can hold up clearing Suez as long as he pleases, or as long as Russia wants him to, and we're forced to send money and oil to prevent a collapse all over Europe while Nasser takes his revenge and holds everything up, how many billions will it take out of our pockets before it's over? Not only Britain and France, but now even the UN itself is complaining it can't get Nasser's consent to do the job right. Nasser says he will not give his consent until Israel moves out. Well, when did the UN abdicate to Nasser? Why don't the UN get Nasser and Israel together and get a peace agreement? They were supposed to do that about 6 years ago. What about the Middle East? Well, hardly a man alive can guarantee tonight whether the new Eisenhower Declaration will put us into a war or keep us out of one. I think it would help keep us out, but that's 90% hope on my part. I don't know, and I don't know anyone who does. I don't know of anybody who could really figure out the Russian moves whenever they're made. The one hope for peace in the Middle East is in three men getting into a room and keeping everybody else out. President Eisenhower, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion, and President Nasser. Have all three in a room and wait until an agreement is drawn and make sure it's an agreement for peace. If we get that, we'll get somewhere. Without that, it'll be Uncle Sam pay and pay and pay and pay and pay. Here's a suggestion respectfully offered. Mr. Eisenhower's message pointed up two great dangers, Russia and inflation. But there's a third, the growing tendency to deny jobs to people over 45 and 50. You know, that can hurt us more in time than inflation, deflation, or reflation all combined. Because our reservoir is a buying power. And if you liquidate millions of people over 45 by refusing to hire them and they can't maintain their buying power, good night, my countrymen. Good night. Well, a dramatic call tonight to President Eisenhower and to Vice President Nixon. 60 Negro leaders in the South appeal to the President and the Vice President to come and see what they call a reign of terror. They virtually say, Mr. Vice President, you investigated terror in Hungary. See it here, they say. No reply yet from Washington. Well, that man who time-bombed an airliner with 44 on board, you remember. collect his mother's insurance. He goes to a gas chamber in Cannon City, Colorado tonight. They should say he shows a remarkable inner calm. Well, name the toughest job in all the world tonight. I'll do it for you. You try and tell a typical Englishman or Frenchman why his country's move to stop Russia's monkey shine in the Middle East was morally wrong, and why our move, if we're forced to make it, is to be morally right. Your Englishman or Frenchman will say we rushed in to fill a vacuum before the Russians could. With us out, you've got the same vacuum which you may have to fill now to beat Russia to the punch again. The man in London and Paris may be wrong. There may be a big difference. We would go in only if called in by the invaded country, only if ordered in by the UN. There is a difference. But the man in London and Paris would say, look, let's stop splitting hairs. In the end, it's we or the Russians, isn't it? I'm afraid he's right. And the man in London and Paris would say, suppose Russia gets control of Syria with a puppet government, and Russian influence and power keep rushing in, and we yell, hey, that's aggression. And the crowd running the government in Syria for the Russians says, mind your own business. Well, we'd be forced to sit on our hands, wouldn't we? Or do as Britain and France did and go in regardless. You know, arguing that is just about the toughest job in the entire world tonight. And before I sign off for the weekend, I want to say this plain, sharp, and clear. What this country needs tonight is to find men who really know the Middle East and have them tell us, are we better off to lay it on the line and sign a blank check for troops and money, or better watch our step and meet each situation as it comes up? Obviously, whatever was done in the past wouldn't seem to indicate we had the advice of men who really know the Middle East, inside and out. I mean the part of tourists and maybe some diplomats never see. Well, have a nice weekend, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.